All right, here we go. Good evening, and thank you to the November 17, 2015 regular meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District. We are missing Mr. Millar this evening, who is not feeling well, so we will proceed without him. During closed session this evening, the board discussed a student personnel matter. We discussed conference with our labor negotiators regarding CSEA and SLCTA, and the board reached an agreement with regard to the superintendent's contract negotiation. We will now move on to our action items. Is there a consensus on the order of business?
Yes.
Everyone good? Okay. We need to take action on our stipulated student discipline agreement, so we need a motion.
I'll make a motion to approve the stipulated student discipline agreement.
I will second that.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So we have 6 in favor with one absence, although he did sign. Well, we'll figure that out. We have approval of minutes from November 3rd, 2015. Any changes? Any discussion?
A second?
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Next, we have approval of the minutes from our study session of November 10th. Any changes, revisions?
I'll move approval.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
And next, our student representatives to the board. Thank you for coming, and nice that one of you has less of a schlep tonight. And Bella, thank you for making the drive.
Hello. So I do not have a very extensive report today. We just finished up our food drive as an ASB. We had a school goal and we reached it. I think we had about 900 pounds of food that we're donating as a school, which is awesome. That's going straight to the food bank. And then we had specific items that are going straight to grassroots, who feeds the homeless population around our school area, mainly right there in Slo County at the Grange Hall the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. So that was a very cool thing to see our school. It was actually very competitive because the sophomores were beating the seniors, and that's unacceptable, and they actually won. So it was a very competitive food drive. CIF girls made it in girls volleyball, and our girls made it to the finals in cross country. We have winter sports who are having all their tryouts going on right now. We are at the end of the trimester. This week is finals week for us, so there are a lot of encouragement signs around our school pleading with us to study and making sure that we do well. Also, our ASB has been doing a lot of integration with our special education program. We've been making it a focus to, we started up our buddy club again, like I've previously discussed, and we've been having our teams go in during our ASB class periods and developing relationships with the 13 kids in the middle tier group that we work really closely with for our integration with them, and it's been really, really wonderful. So that's all I have today.
Thank you.
Like Slo High, there hasn't been much going around in MBHS, but girls volleyball did make it to CIF this year. And although our girls cross country team did not win league as they thought that they would, a freshman, Audrey McClish, actually placed first at the league finals race for our varsity girls. So that was pretty impressive. And boys soccer and basketball are about to start, and our first games will be the week coming back from Thanksgiving holiday with a HIT tournament basketball at MBHS. And school news, the word is that there's going to be no more free periods or teacher aids at MBHS next year, much to the uproar of the students. They don't really like that much. Glad to be a senior this year. And also, ASB is trying to decide where they're going to be working next semester because of lack of space. Maybe the bus barn is going to be moved into for Mr. Bueno. And although unassociated with MBHS officially, but with MBHS, the Surf Club has a team with members of MBHS, and they will be competing in the Scholastic Surf Series down at Zuma Beach this weekend. So that's news from MBHS this week.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks very much. I'll be one of those people encouraging you to study. So if you should you need it, thank you both for taking the time to come report to us tonight. And I'm assuming you'll want to carry on with your evening elsewhere. But thanks for taking the time. We always appreciate it. Thank you. Okay, next we have public comment, and this time is set aside for people who wish to address the board regarding an item not on the regular agenda, or if you don't want to wait for that item to come up on the agenda, now's your time. Is anyone wishing to address the board at this time? All right, thank you. I skipped correspondence. I received one letter from someone expressing a desire to make sure that environmental issues and recycling kinds of issues were addressed in our schools. So now we are on to superintendent's updates. First is business and budget update.
Recently, we attended the Central Coast Economic Forecast. It was a great event. Mr. Unger, Ms. Sheffer, Mr. Robinette, Mr. Prater were both there. One of our esteemed colleagues, Mr. Palazzo, here is actually the chairman of the Economic Forecast, and it was a great event that was held at the Madonna Inn. In terms of the overall look, and they basically had two economists talking about the economy, both worldwide. Wide, nationwide, statewide, and so definitely things are, you know, from what we heard, things are on the rise, things are good, specifically here in the Central Coast. They really painted a pretty positive picture about the economy in the Central Coast and where we're headed, you know, at this current time. So despite what's happening in China and all those Greece and those other areas, for now, it looks like we're going to continue to see some economic growth in our area, which is a positive thing. We did find out from the county, we actually got our property tax assessment this week, and so it looks like our property taxes were higher than initially estimated to us, so they came in at 5.07%, which is a positive thing, and again shows more a really healthy economy here on the Central Coast, and so it's a positive thing.
Great. Good. Thank you. Thanks. Next, educational services update.
Thank you. Today, we met with representatives from the County Office of Education to discuss our local control accountability plan timeline and procedures for this year. And so at the next board meeting, we will share our timelines, our outreach efforts, and changes in any expectations for the LCAP with the board. I want to remind the Board of Education that this Friday, November 20th, we will be having a board study session on high school graduation requirements. Among the things we will discuss is what Nick brought up tonight. This will give our high school principals and counselors an opportunity to share some insights with the board and for us to dialogue about recent ed code changes, expectations in light of UC, CSU, A through G admissions, data about our current student programs. So that's 9 a.m. this Friday. And just a reminder, we are in the middle of elementary conference week. We have minimum days and parent conferences occurring in the afternoons leading up to a full week off for Thanksgiving break next week. And that's all I have to report at this time.
Great. Thank you. Next, we have our Measure D update.
On Friday, the board had another conversation about design-build, as well as the rest of the projects at both of our comprehensive high schools, San Luis Obispo High School, as well as Morro Bay High School. This has been an ongoing dialogue, of course, with the board. We actually talked initially on way back in January, February of 2015, and then have really gotten into discussions October 16th, October 20th board meeting, last Friday, and again, we'll find it as is as a public hearing and resolution tonight, and the focus is mainly on the kind of core classroom modernizations at both comprehensive high schools. This is really the focus of these projects at the current state. Just so the board knows, too, we have had follow-up meetings with all three architecture firms in terms of our design bid build projects, getting the timelines worked out, the dates, you know, kind of some of the blanks that we had to fill in those contracts. Those will, I think they were actually emailed to Mr. Holcomb today. He'll be reviewing those, and then they'll be going to Dr. Prater for his signature along back out to the architects for their signatures. And so it's exciting that we're going to get some projects off and running, and it was really kind of cool to actually see that calendar and see when things are going to come down and timelines, and I think I've told the board we're going to get some signs out at the site to kind of show the public what we're doing, and we'll tie all of that together.
Thank you. All right, we're moving on to our item 8.01, Transitional Kindergarten Equity Length of Time Waiver. Mrs. Shields.
Code, thank you. Transitional kindergarten programs that are operated by the school district must be of equal length to regular kindergarten classrooms. In San Luis Coastal, over the last few years, some of our kindergarten classes were already had extended days, and the others have all joined, where all nine of our elementary schools have extended kindergarten days. We've not done that with transitional kindergarten, and based on our developmental program for these younger students, we don't believe it's appropriate. So tonight, in order to request a waiver from the state, we first have to have a public hearing. So I'm here to offer that for you to have tonight.
Thank you. So at this time, we will open the public hearing. Is there any public testimony regarding the transitional kindergarten equity length of time waiver? We will now close the public hearing on this matter. Now it's okay, Mr. Pinkerton. So
yes.
Next we have Measure D, determination to enter into design build agreement.
Yes, our next public hearing on this matter. So we'll talk a little bit about it more, I would say, at the next item on the agenda. But at this point, as part of the process of the board potentially moving forward with the design build, we have to have a public hearing on that matter.
All right, we will open the public hearing at this time regarding determination to enter into design build agreements. Is there anyone here wishing to give testimony on this matter? All right, I will close the public hearing. Now, it's my understanding we're not required to have a second hearing on this matter, is that correct? So should we wish to, later on in the meeting, we can go ahead and act on the resolution when it comes forward, which is our next item. How convenient.
Yes.
All right. So is the board comfortable acting on the resolution at this time? Why don't you describe it, and then we'll see where we stand.
So the board, as the item outlines, the board has moved forward with design bid build on several projects that we felt were better suited for that potential delivery method, and to get some projects going, started. And then in looking at, as we've discussed again at all of those board study sessions and board meetings, the modernization and really the core classroom buildings at both Morro Bay High School, as well as the 100 core classroom, cafeteria, performance space area at San Luis Obispo High School. Those two, we feel, kind of fit better with the design-build scenario, in that major construction, to have one potential construction firm, architect group under that umbrella. We feel like really the two things, both cost as well as efficiency in terms of being able to get the projects done in a quicker pace, are really the two keys. The resolution itself on the second or really last section kind of outlines really the positive things that we feel we can accomplish moving forward with a design build delivery method at both schools.
Thank you. Again, out of just to be certain, I'm going to ask if there's any public input on this matter. And I will ask come back to the board and ask if everyone is comfortable with proceeding with the resolution this evening.
I'll move approval of resolution number 061516.
Mr. Buckman.
I'll second.
All right. Any further discussion? Resolution.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers? Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mr. Questenberry?
Yes.
Passes 6 with 1 absence. Mr. Millar.
Carry on. All right. So our discussion items for this evening, our first topic is athletic safety protocols.
Great, thank you. We are moving this meeting along.
Yeah.
This is great. As we all know, with extracurricular sports activities comes a degree of risk, and we've discussed this as a board before, but with risk has also come a lot of understanding about the proactive and reactive ways we deal with that risk. And so tonight I'd like to have a presentation and really an opportunity for the board and the public, if necessary or desired, to just find out about what we do at our two comprehensive high schools where we have CIFs. Sports. I've asked Jeff Brandow, who is the athletic director from San Luis Obispo High School, and John Andre, the athletic director from Morro Bay High School, to come and address this subject with the board and answer questions. And I also, we also have with us, and he'll be also available and be available to the board, Andrew Cherry, who I've known as a former administrator. Andrew was the principal at Templeton High School for several years, but he now is part of in charge of educational outreach for San Luis Sports Therapy, which is someone we contract with for all of our athletic training and with our concussion protocol. So Andrew's also here to talk to the board. So with that, I'd like to just turn it over to our athletic directors and let them share a brief presentation about athletic safety.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Good.
I've been asked to talk about injuries in general, with not sports specific, and then Mr. Brando is going to come up and talk about football specific injuries. So the teacher and me, I put together a little PowerPoint presentation for you, so you can go ahead and follow along. Let's start with our coaches first. All of our coaches are certified. State law requires all coaches, volunteers, to be trained every 2 years in the following area: concussions, heat, cardiac awareness, and we require all of our coaches and volunteers to do this annually. All coaches or volunteers are also CPR or first aid certified. And we do this every 2 years through their certification process. Now for student athletes, all student athletes are required to complete an athletic packet prior to participating in extracurricular sports. This packet includes physicals. Each student has to have a physical prior to participating, by a medical, licensed medical doctor. The health history, they have to list their health history. That helps us determine if they have any problems that might arise. And then they also have to have proof of insurance. Now, overall safety, our athletic trainers are on site Monday through Fridays. And for practices and all home events, they're also here for any tournaments or anything on the weekends. Our athletic trainers are trained in the prevention, diagnosis, and intervention of emergencies, acute and chronic medical conditions involving impairment, functional limitations, and disabilities, musculoskeletal injury prevention, rehabilitation, and treatment. We also have AEDs throughout the school in our gyms, both gyms, and in the trainer's room. And our athletic trainer is trained in how to do that, as well as myself. We've both been certified in that.
Chris,
the AEDs, yes. The,
yeah.
John,
Chris,
can I ask you a question, John?
Yeah. Sure.
The slide before, you said students must provide proof of insurance.
Right.
If a student doesn't have insurance, what do we do? Do we do things to help them get insurance? You know.
Well, absolutely.
Like
we have two ways to do this. One is that the student, if they don't have insurance, they can get a plan that fits them through Myers-Stevens, and we're also working on one through CISC right now, too, for next year. Or what we do is, if a student can't pay for it, we, as the athletic department or through our needy student fund, pay for a student so no kid is turned away from playing sports.
And Mr. Andre, would that also be true of the physical?
Yes. In fact, we both San Luis and Morro Bay hold physicals usually in May for students, and it's free, but we ask for a $20 donation, and some parents pay for it, and those who can't get free physicals.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. The next is injury protocol. With minor injuries, if an athlete is injured, it reports to the coach, who sends that athlete to the trainer, or the athlete will directly go to the trainer, and then the trainer will report back to the coach. The athlete is evaluated at that time for the nature and severity of the injury. If an athlete can pass functional tests, the athlete is taped and returned to activity. If a student cannot pass functional tests, he or she is pulled from the activity and is either iced or started a treatment rehab protocol or referred to a physician for further evaluation. Continuing with minor injuries, we do treatment rehab. The protocols include heat, ice, electric stim, therapeutic exercise where they can do this at home or with our trainer with bands, and then manual stretching. They also work on taping, wrapping, splinting, as well as working with crutches if they need those. Continuing with injury protocol, in the event that an athlete is going to be out of practice or competition for an extended period of time, the parent is notified by the athletic trainer or the coach. Most of our coaches, we've talked to them that if there is an injury, to call home and just talk to the parent and inform them that their child has been injured. A lot of times the parents don't know that, and then we usually send them to the trainer, and the trainer will then call the mother if it's she deems necessary. The coaches are also notified as a status of the athlete. They never make a decision on whether a player goes back into the game. That is up to our athletic trainer, and she has sole authority on that. So we defer to her as the expert. Now, we do have emergency protocols in place. I didn't want to go through all those. That we could have been here for an hour to go over that. But we have them in place for asthma, brain injuries, diabetes, heat stroke, exertional, sick lean, lightning safety, cardiac arrest, and the athletic trainer, as well as all the stipend coaches, are CPR and first aid trained, like I said before. And in the event of an emergency, if the parent or guardian is not present, we have little forms that the coaches have. If they're off campus, then they can take that child to the hospital, and the parents are called immediately. And then that's when the protocols for the above-mentioned conditions begin, depending on the severity of the injury.
Just the games that I've attended, there's an ambulance present. Is that something that's
continuous? No, normally what we have, like at regular sporting events, we just have the athletic trainer with an on-call. She'll call 911 if there's a problem. If it's a football game, both San Luis and us have a doctor, a medical doctor on site that will evaluate. And if we need to call an ambulance, they're usually 2 or 3 minutes away. And that's what I have all for my presentation. Mr. Brando will now come up and talk about football specifically. Are there any more questions?
Did you have a question?
Chris.
So I guess maybe this is a question for Mr. Cherry. I'm curious about what's some of the specific training that the trainers get, and I'm impressed that the trainer gets the last word on whether a student goes back into a game or not. So that kind of takes the pressure off the coach, right?
Oh, absolutely. And
yeah,
we want to keep it out of their hands.
Right, exactly. So I like I said, I'd be curious to find out more just about the specificity of training for the athletic trainers. And I don't know if that's something Mr. Cherry can answer, or if we want to wait on that. I'm good waiting on that too.
Well, I'll let him. He knows more about their professional
Thanks,
development.
Hello. To answer your question specifically, basically all of our trainers at a minimum have a bachelor's degree from an accredited university. It's an athletic training education. They are nationally board certified. They're the only medical trained professional usually on site at these games, and so they're trained specifically with their ongoing CEUs and stuff like that to be the first responder, and as you know, John mentioned, be able to determine whether or not an ambulance needs to be called or whatever the case may be. So they're really experts in sort of that emergency protocol, if you will. But every one of our trainers has a degree and is board certified.
Marilyn, we have a couple people with other people questions. Marilyn, then Catherine.
Oh, sure. I had a question. I think maybe it's for Mr. Andre or whomever. The card that you talked about, what if you have a student athlete who is seriously injured in the course of of athletics, and the parents can't be reached, does that card authorize the coach to make medical decisions? Or
no, it authorizes him to be able to take that child to the hospital, and it allows them to provide care. It's called an emergency treatment form, and the parent signs that it's okay for their child to be treated.
And so then the doctor would determine whatever needs to be done.
At the hospital, couldn't be reached. Usually we'd call 911 and take an ambulance ride, and the coach would be with that student, and then that sheet would allow the doctor to be able to provide care. And each one of the students, and we make copies and give those to our coaches so they have them with them at all times.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Andre.
Yes.
Did I understand you to say that there is a medical doctor at every football game at San Luis Obispo High School, but not at Moore?
No, at both schools.
At both schools.
Okay. We have Dr. Fow, who donates his time and comes to all of our games.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, great. I'll go ahead and turn it over to Mr. Brando, who'll talk about football.
Thank you, Mr. Andre. Last time I was in front of the school board and Dr. Prater, I just want to give you guys an update. Last year we talked about 14 additional stipends, and I wanted to be the bearer of good news. We've added freshman girls basketball this year. We've also added freshman boys soccer and freshman girls soccer. So we have about 45 kids who are going to participate in the winter athletics that normally would not have had that opportunity. So I wanted to thank you guys for that opportunity. I'm here to talk about football. It's actually not the most dangerous sport. High school cheerleading actually has more injuries than football. But I want to touch base with you guys about football and some of the football-specific things that we do. Obviously, with the events that have happened at Templeton High School and the things we've read about in the newspaper and the fatalities, obviously it's a hot-button issue. The word concussion is obviously a hot-button issue, and I'm happy that you guys are having us here to have this discussion. So we'll start with officials and referees, and this is something that John and myself started, and we've led the way on this, to be honest with you. Both of our schools have lower numbers in terms of football players and the number of players on teams. A normal high school JV or frosh football game would have four referees. We've gone above that and asked for an additional referee, so now we have five. It's a cost of about $70, but that's peanuts when you look at what's happening. So we've extended that to five. At varsity, they normally have five officials. Both schools have reached out and asked for seven officials. That's something we had this year. And I think John would attest that it's been a huge, huge benefactor for us to have those extra set of eyes out there, to throw extra flags, and to be out there and be diligent. And we've led the way on that. The Pac-8, the league that we're in athletically, the other athletic directors have kind of taken a step back and looked at it and realized, okay, this is a big issue, and it's something we should think about moving forward. Another thing that both schools do is we videotape all of our games. At the varsity level, we videotape from an up-top angle and an in-zone angle. We examine the footage, and in quite a few circumstances, we'll actually send those clips to the Los Padres Football Official Association and ask for clarity, why a penalty was called, why a penalty was not called, here's a helmet-to-helmet hit, this should have been done, blah, blah, blah. So that's another thing we do to ensure safety. As John touched on, we exceed California. It's actually California State guideline in terms of training. It's supposed to be done every 2 years. We do it every year. Most of our coaches are not very happy about that, but it needs to be on the forefront of everyone's mind. So in terms of concussion and heat and illness, we do that training every single year.
So I have a quick question.
Yep.
With regard to the, you indicated that at times you send tapes to be reviewed by the higher-ups.
By the official association, correct.
And then do you receive feedback back from
yes.
them indicating...
It's a very political answer, but yes, they will admit when they make a mistake. When there's a missed call and a kid who's on the ground gets hit, it's called a defenseless player. If he gets hit and there wasn't a flag thrown, or maybe the kid should have been ejected, they will acknowledge we should have made that call, we should have done this. The officials, whether at the frosh level, the JV level, or the varsity level, they will actually sit down and watch the game tape, and it's something where the word concussion is on everyone's mind. And I think the referees are very aware of that, and they've been more proactive in the last couple of years.
So you share that feedback back with the referees?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We share it with the coaches. I sit down with the coaches, and John does the same thing. We sit as a coaching staff, the athletic director. We watch it. We debate, should we send this in? We always err on the side of caution. We send it in. They respond back to us. I'll touch on it in a second, but really one of the biggest things that's happened in the state of California with high school football is CIF, and actually the state of California, has instituted a lot of new guidelines about the numbers of hours a week you can practice, what you can do in terms of live tackling. I don't want to use the word good old days, but it's not like the good old days where you can have 4-hour practices and do tackling all day. It's completely different than that. And what we've seen, and John and I both talked about it, what we've seen is a shift from injuries in practice to now where we have very few, if any, injuries in practice because they're not really tackling, to now more of the injuries are actually happening in games. And we've had this discussion. John's son plays freshman football at San Luis Obispo High School. They've shifted away from having live tackling during practices. Well, now you throw a bunch of teenagers in a game who technically have never tackled all the way to the ground or haven't done it very much. So now you're seeing more injuries in games. So that's been kind of a shift the last couple of years. Let's talk about football-specific safety equipment. Our district, both schools, are on the cutting edge of this. We have top-notch equipment. We use the same helmets, the same shoulder pads that pro and college teams do. Both schools recondition their equipment every year. Technically, only need to do it every 2 years, but again, we do it every year. The gentleman from Rydell is actually going to come tomorrow, and he's going to pick up 100 helmets and 100 sets of shoulder pads. They take them back. They examine them. They test them. Quite often, there'll be things that are borderline. We throw them out. We use them. We use the helmet to sign it and give it to somebody as a gift. We don't use it. On an annual basis, San Luis Obispo High School spends about $20,000 a year on reconditioning new helmets, buying new helmets, buying new shoulder pads. It's something we do not shortchange. A standard helmet nowadays can cost $300, $400, $500, and if that was my son, we'd want him to have the best helmet. So it's not something we cut corners on. Again, the helmets and shoulder pads are inspected and reconditioned. Safety equipment, you know, the best analogy for this would be, it was a freshman football game this year, and you got kids who've never played football before, and they're out there, and they forget their mouthpiece. Well, our coaches and our trainers are trained. They check all the kids, especially at the lower levels. You don't have a mouthpiece, go get a mouthpiece. Where's your chin strap? You forgot your knee pads. That happens all the time. Kid got a haircut. Helmet doesn't fit him right anymore. They adjust the helmet to give him a different size. So those are, again, things that football-specific safety equipment we look at. Touching base on the practice and game structure, like I talked about, there's a state law. You're allowed to have 20 hours of practice a week, practice slash game time. We do not do live tackling in practices. On every Monday at San Luis Obispo High School, actually, we bring out pads, and the kids, they never tackle all the way to the ground. They work on their technique, and they sometimes go down to the pad, but they never tackle all the way to the ground. A safe tackling circuit is taught on a weekly basis to reinsure with the head up, not never leading with the head, never leading with the crown of the helmet. The athletic trainer, talking about games now, the athletic trainer and the team medical doctor are present on the sideline during all the games, especially during the varsity games. I've made the mistake of going on the field and trying to talk to my athletic trainer while the varsity football game is going on, and literally, the athletic trainer stands right here, the team doctor, we have two at San Luis Obispo, stands right next to him, and they follow the ball. Wherever the ball is, they watch the ball. They watch every collision, they watch how every kid stands up, they watch every reaction, and now it's gotten to the point where the referees, even if a kid stands up and he's woozy, they pull him right away, and they're examining him. One of them examines the kid, while the other one keeps his eyes on the ball, eyes on play at all times to make sure they don't miss anything. Most of the time at San Luis Obispo, we're lucky to have an ambulance present. It's on standby. We don't get charged for it. They do come and go, but again, they're very close by if we do need them. In terms of tackling, both schools teach the heads-up tackling, which is a newer thing recently. It's instead of leading with the head, it's basically you have your head up and your eyes forward at all times. You can always see the person you're tackling. You never lead with your crown or your head, the top of your head. You never want to hit somebody at the top of your head. We use the hands and the hips while blocking, not the head or the shoulders. Again, the emphasis being away from using your head as a weapon or leading with your head. We teach the players how to use the body position to protect themselves from defenseless hits, and we never have players lead and try to hit other players with their helmet. That's been one of the emphasis this year for the Referees Association is to call helmet-to-helmet contact. Concussion protocol, I'll skip forward to this in a second, but I just want to start by saying that I've never seen anything like this. When I came up here, I came from San Diego. I worked at two different high schools down there, and the extent to which we go in terms of concussion protocol is amazing. You guys made the point. You take it away from the coaches. The final step in the concussion protocol is the principal, the athletic director, the parents, and the student-athletes sit in a room. There's no coaches. It's far away from the field of competition, and there's an open dialogue. And I can tell you this year at least we've had two or three times where a kid was cleared by a doctor, the athletic trainer, he went through all the steps, and the kid was just a little nervous or the parent was a little nervous. And Leslie didn't clear him. He said, nope, you're not cleared. You're not going to play. You're not going to go back in. It's not worth it. So this is a big, big deal. The final step of are they cleared to play, rests in the hands of Dr. Pruitt and Mr. O'Connor. They make the decision. And this is after a medical doctor's cleared them. This is after they go through the seven steps. This is after they have a seven-day process. So it's a big, big deal. This is what the concussion protocol looks like. Basically, prevention. All kids are given impact tests. We did this for our cheerleaders this year. Football, soccer, basketball, wrestling. We did water polo. We try to extend it to as many student-athletes as we possibly can. Basically, the student-athlete will come in and they'll take an impact test, and they'll get a baseline number. The next thing that happens is a concussion is suspected. If a concussion is suspected by an official, if a concussion is suspected by a coach, if a concussion is suspected by the athletic trainer, you know, we have oftentimes where a kid will be traveling down to Santa Maria and that athletic trainer will suspect a concussion. At that point, if a concussion is suspected, the student athlete is pulled out of the game. We always err on the side of caution. The next step is treatment. And after that, the next step is a medical doctor. That medical doctor has to clear them, has to say they are cleared. Not cleared in 2 weeks, not cleared in a month. They're cleared as of now to return to play. Then they begin the seven-day graduated return to play protocol. I could spend an hour describing it to you, but basically every day they do a little bit more. One day they run, one day they do agility, then they go into practice and they don't have contact, then they go into practice and have contact, then they have to wait 24 hours, then we set up a meeting. It's a very lengthy process. In all honesty, a high school football player who gets a concussion is probably going to miss 2 weeks of games. It's about the average. They usually miss 2 to 3 weeks, and they don't play for 2 to 3 weeks. And again, it's to err on the side of caution, to err on, as Leslie always says, we care about what you're going to be like 5, 10, 20 years from now, not what you're going to be like Friday night. So that's the concussion protocol. I'm sure Dr. Chair can expand on that if you guys want. Any questions related to football protocol? What we do football-wise,
Chris.
You know, I really appreciate what you've told us and the information you've shared tonight. One thing, I don't know if it's something that our coaching staff should continue to really advocate for, or if it's something that we should take to Southern Section CIF, because I know we have CIF representatives, typically you guys and the school principal,
right.
But. The idea of having a seven person refereeing team out there instead of a 5-person refereeing team, I'm so glad we're doing it at our schools. I'd like to see that's done at the other schools that we're playing at too. So Santa Maria, I don't know where we go, Paso,
yeah,
Atascadero. I just, you know, for 70, for 100, basically what you're saying is $140 a game. We're increasing safety for our students.
Yep,
and it seems to me that's something that we should continue to advocate for. I don't know where the best place to do it, but I think I'm going to just ask that you guys do that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. It's something that John and I actually came up with. We were having lunch, and we were talking about it and what can we do. And, you know, I don't want to say we're in a tough spot, but our two schools, number-wise, number of football players, you know, we compete in the Pac-5. You know, where we're competing, where they're competing, the numbers, all that. Our biggest thing is always we got to keep the kids safe. We got to keep the numbers up. If you don't have numbers in football, you're always going to struggle. And when there becomes injuries or concussions or you're losing a lot of games, that's when kids stop playing and that's when it becomes really negative. So as athletic directors, we do everything we possibly can. I know with the Pac-8, I know John's had the same conversation, we're trying to push the envelope with the other athletic directors in our league. Like, look, this is affecting everybody. Most schools' numbers are down or even or down a little bit in terms of numbers of players. So we'll continue to push that. It's definitely something we could bring up with our area representative as well, CIF.
Well, I'm also glad to see that you're doing the concussion protocols for basketball, soccer,
yep,
cheerleading, wrestling,
absolutely,
water polo. Because, you know, I think it's not just football. And as you say, football is not the most dangerous sport. Any sport where there's, you know, possible,
yep,
contact with your head is going to have the potential for a concussion.
Yep.
So I'm glad,
absolutely,
you guys are doing it, too. I think that's really important.
Thank Mark, you. Then Jim.
Thanks, all. So as we started to get into the Measure D campaign and some other talk that I've heard around the state, the artificial turf comes up, and my understanding is it's actually more dangerous for the players. Is that?
You know, I don't know for certain, to be honest with you. I'm not going to mislead you, and I've heard both. I've heard it's better. I've heard it's worse. I know if you come look at certain, I don't know John's field as well, but if you come look at certain areas of our field, Holt Field is in my opinion, the best grass field around. I think some of the other fields need a lot of work and a lot of love. We got a lot of mud going on between our two gyms right now. I don't know the answer to that. I know that there are potholes and stuff like that, but there are pros and cons to AstroTurf and grass. But I don't know the answer to that.
Jim and Marilyn?
This is a very nice PowerPoint presentation. Are you or John sharing this with the parents? Usually at the end of the summer or the beginning of the fall, you have a meeting with parents, prospective athletes. And I don't know, is that meeting done 3 times a year for each?
Yeah, we both do it 3 times a year. Our winter sports parent night is actually tomorrow night. I touch briefly on this. Leslie says the same thing. I'll say it again. There is an inherent risk to playing sports. I mean, there's no way around that, whether it's cheerleading, basketball, volleyball, water polo. I mean, kids break their noses, they get concussions, they turn their ankles. I touch base on it a little bit. Our athletic trainer comes in and actually does about a 5 to 8 minute presentation related mostly to concussions and the concussion protocol.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
We do have Andrew Cherry here, who knows about the impact protocol, but there's anything that you want to add or questions you might have regarding the trainers and our concussion protocols would be appropriate here.
I would be interested in hearing what the impact protocol looks like. I know we talked about that 3 or 4 years ago. Remember, we had somebody from the hospital and from San Luis Sports come over when it was first being introduced. So I'd be interested in hearing more specifics about that.
The entire protocol is actually quite lengthy, and Stacy Ritter, who oversees our program, is as much of an expert in that as anybody. But it is essentially, you know, the whole protocol, it's medically, it's evidence-based, it's best practice recommendations, it's outlined by several national organizations, it's in compliant with California state law and the CIF bylaws, and in regards to, like, immediate removal from play and some of the things they talked about already. There's baseline and post-injury neurocognitive and balance testing involved with that. Afterwards, there's daily supervision of mandatory graduated return to protocol, which I know the athletic directors know. It's much more widely accepted now, but you know, some of those kids want to get back out there, but it is very meticulous in how they go through that process. They coordinate with school counselors and teachers needed for academic considerations at times, if needed. I think another huge piece is it's the collaboration with family doctors and that network that they provide with easy access. And then there's just that parent, coach, and player education. And there are some other things. I know the North County at Twin Cities, they had a concussion type of event for people to come in, for, you know, just youth coaches to come and check out parents as well. So we're trying to get more of that stuff out there as well. The one piece I wanted to add, and I'm going to take myself out of my current job right now, and they said some things. I think John had mentioned it, and Jeff maybe said the same thing. I think the biggest piece you have, and as a former principal, is just critical, is when you have, like, San Luis Sports Therapy doing this, you have a completely objective person in the middle. There's not a coach who's maybe wound up or thinking about the game, who's not really concentrating on that individual candidate. They are trained to objectively, literally stand in front of the coach if need be, if they think that player shouldn't be going back into the game. And so their number one thought is the child's health. They could care less about the outcome of the game. They can really care less about the kids' wishes. They could care less about the parents' wishes, for that matter. When they think that child's injured and there's a chance for further injury, they are going to keep them out of the game. And it's great to hear that we have athletic directors, and I think they all do. They support that, because that is, I think, the most critical piece. You know, I think at times when you have on-site people and things like that, there's that tendency to, you know, they know the kids, and they get kind of going with the whole system. We really make sure that it's very objective, and we are purely looking out for the students. Safety. And so, as I said, there's inherent risks in sports. We all know that. But they really step in and look out for that, not only just at the time of the game, but they look in prevention during the game, in emergency situations, and in rehabilitation, getting them back into the game. And so we are, by all accounts, a model county, because every school in this county has an athletic trainer full-time at their campus. And we are setting the bar pretty high to the point where other counties are starting to look at this and say, hey, maybe we need to do some of those things for our kids. A lot of talk up in Santa Cruz right now in that area wanting a similar program. So that's the main thing I wanted to add in terms of that. Any other questions about the concussion piece?
No. Thank you very much for a very informative discussion here this evening. Thanks. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to speak on this?
Okay. Thank you. And thank you to our guests for taking the time to come out. All right, next we have a discussion regarding English learner program interventions.
Good evening. It's my pleasure to introduce Dawn Addis, our K-12 English learner intervention teacher on special assignment, who will actually be presenting the update on our English learner program. You should have received in your board packet achievement data for our English learners, both from the California English Learner, I always get my language development test, the CELT test, as well as the SBAC, our most recent results. Tonight, though, Dawn is going to be describing our shift and our real focus that we have going now and that we're moving towards in providing high challenge combined with high support for our English learner students. With that, I'll turn it over to Dawn.
Good evening. So as Amy said, and thank you, Amy, she always does the kind introductions, I'll be presenting a quick update on our English learner programs, and I'm going to do it within the context of all of our English learners being ready for rigor. And so rigor is something that we talk about a lot, but tonight I'm going to share with you a little bit of a definition about that so we can really wrap our minds around what it means to provide rigor for English learners at varying levels of proficiency. So there's in your packet, you received the CELT and SBAC results, and I think one of the major takeaways that I wanted to point out as I get into the presentation is that English language development and English language proficiency really does correlate with academic achievement. And I think what you could see in some of those graphs is that as our students increase in their English language proficiency, their SBAC results also increased. And so what we know from that is that it's important to hone our instruction for where students are at in their English language development. So I'm just, as we're going through the presentation, be keeping that in mind as part of the context. There's three things on the agenda. First, I'll be talking a little bit about what rigor is, specifically as it relates to English learners. Then what our English learner program focus is as it relates to rigor. And then the English learner rigor in action. So really taking a look at what's happening in our classrooms and what's happening with our learning communities. So when we think about rigor, I wanted to share this graphic with you because it's something that's been around in the English language development research for a long time, and it's in our English language arts, English language development framework. And I think all of you, when I say the word rigor, right away think it's high challenge, right? So we'll get rid of the bottom half of that graph. And we're really focused up here on the idea that high challenge is about engaging our English learners in grade level curriculum and Common Core aligned content and instruction. But two things can happen for our English learners. One is that they may not get enough language development support, which can leave our students frustrated and kind of tuned out to instruction. So what we really want is to be in this high support learning zone where students are engaged in a way that matches their language development needs, right? And so this is very much differentiated in terms of if students are at beginning levels of language proficiency or more advanced levels of proficiency. So as I go through and you hear me say rigor over and over and over, be thinking about this graphic and be thinking about the idea that for English learners, rigor is really about the high challenge of grade level content combined with the high support of English development strategies and scaffolds. So the first thing in terms of thinking about our English learner program focus, I just wanted to share this statement with you. I color-coded it because it's kind of a mouthful, but really what we're focused on is everything I've just explained, the high challenge, high support rigor through differentiated programming, but also the idea that students need to learn English while they're simultaneously learning grade level content. And when I was here last year, I kind of talked about this idea that English is not the on-ramp to grade level content, that now in California, we have to be doing both in tandem. So our first group of students that I wanted to talk about in terms of rigor and in terms of the idea of high challenge, high support are our newcomers and our students at CELT Beginning and CELT Early Intermediate. And we kind of have three focus areas here. The first is language acceleration, because we really need to get these students talking as quickly as possible so that they can communicate their needs, so they can engage with peers, and so they can begin their work on grade level content. In addition to that, this is where we provide very targeted supports through our EL specialists, our ELD teachers, and our EL instructional assistants who work with smaller groups of students, either pushing into the classroom or sometimes in a pullout setting, and are really honing in on the language development part of the high challenge, high support rigor that we're providing. And then thirdly, leveraging technology, we have Rosetta Stone, as I'm sure you know, that we use with our beginners and our new newcomers and our early intermediate students, so that students are engaging in personalized language development. So that's one group of students that we work with. The second group of students are students who are sort of moving along in their language development. And when we think about rigor or high challenge, high support for these students, we're really moving into academic language, so teaching academic vocabulary, but also teaching discipline-specific language structures. So the way we talk in a math class is different from the way we talk in a social studies class. And also 21st century skills. When we think about collaboration and engaging in dialogue with peers and adults about academic content, being able to argue one's point of view. And then we start to get a little more honed with our intervention. So it's not a one-size-fits-all, every English learner needs an intervention, so much as students who are advancing in their proficiency may need a specific intervention in reading or in writing, or some of these students don't need an intervention because they're progressing as expected. So that's our second group of students. And then a third group of students is somewhat new in California. They're called long-term English learners, or LTELs. And these are students who are in upper elementary or middle or high school. They've been in English language instruction for a number of years, and they've kind of begun to get stuck in their language development. And really where we're at with these students is figuring out who they are, utilizing our data tools. I work closely with our assessment TOSA, Neil Eckhart, and working with Illuminate to figure out who these children are. And then we're piloting what we're calling an LTEL curriculum. So it's a curriculum that really is developed to hone in, again, on that academic language development in reading, writing, speaking, and listening. And this year we're piloting it as an additive intervention. So we know the high challenge for English learners is being engaged in grade level academic content, so we don't want to pull them out of their grade level classes, but we're adding on the curriculum and instruction with the LTEL curriculum in a separate setting so that students get both that high challenge and that high support. So that's kind of where we're at with those three groups of students. In addition to that, San Luis Coastal, I feel fortunate to be a parent here because San Luis Coastal really values parent engagement. And one of the most exciting things about my position has been interacting with our DLAC. And Dr. Prater got to come to DLAC last Thursday and really bear witness to, I'd say, the passion and the excitement that our families have for the education of their children. And so when we think about high support and high challenge for our students, we know that our parent groups are a part of that high support. So we took a group of parent leaders last year to CABE Monterey, the California Association of Bilingual Educators, where parents got to go to workshops in Spanish that focused on Common Core, on the ELD standards, on literacy, on parenting strategies. And I can tell you, even though we went last April, that learning has really stayed with these parents. They've shared at their ELAC, and I know when Dr. Prater came last Thursday, he heard parents referencing things that they had learned at that conference. So really a lot of bang for the buck on that one. And something else we're doing as Latino
Latino literacy, which you might be familiar with, but it's a parent-child literacy class that we have at several elementary schools where parents and children come together to read books that are bilingual, and then they create like a family literacy album that ends up being a keepsake. Some of our parents talk about having had theirs, and their kids are in college now, so really important. But the new thing this year is a middle school, high school class. So Loams and Morro Bay High are offering a class, and then San Luis High and Laguna are offering a class, and it really focuses on college readiness, the pathway to college specifically for Latino students, and kind of unwrapping some of the challenges that Latino families in particular face as they're going down the college readiness path. So we're excited for those offerings. And then lastly, we have our teachers, who we all know we wouldn't be here without our teachers, in classrooms doing important work. So this year in August, I saw Mr. Quesenberry there. I got to in-service all of the elementary and secondary teachers on English language development strategies and really looking at how teachers can integrate language instruction, right? When we think of high challenge, high support, the high challenge of grade level content instruction, and then how teachers can integrate language instruction. We focused on speaking and listening and collaborative academic conversations, and we focused on the ELD standards. In addition to that day, I've worked extensively with our EL specialists and our ELD teachers so they can become leaders on their campuses in terms of supporting instruction for English learners. And then this year, we have some other things that will be happening. So that's really where we're at right now in terms of our English learner programs. Really focused on that differentiation of programming, knowing that we need right time instruction, that we need to be providing a challenging, rigorous environment, but we need to provide support as well through language development. And in terms of next steps, it's really a continuation of things that I've talked to you already about, the focus on rigor and helping our teachers understand what rigor means for English learners. So through ongoing math PD that we have, we're embedding a focus on English learners. We have our elementary PD day where we'll have some English language development focus in that, and then continuing the work with our EL specialists and ELD teachers so they can continue to share the information. And then parent engagement, Amy and I are working on planning more trips to CABE and other kinds of parent engagement sessions. And then, you know, I'm continuing to work with Neil to utilize our data to get real specific, because I can't say enough times that it's not a one-size-fits-all for our English learners. So a lot of information in a short amount of time. I'll wrap up and open up for any questions.
Marilyn and Mark.
Thank you for the presentation, Mrs. Addis. Could you, when you were speaking about LTEL?
Yes.
I didn't understand. It sounds like students who are not who've progressed to a certain point and then are not continuing to progress, but I was unclear on really what kinds of interventions you're putting in place for those kids.
So we're piloting a curriculum. It's called English 3D, and it was designed by Kate Kinsella, who's one of the leaders in the field of English language development, to really focus with students who are long-term English learners on academic language development, but beyond just vocabulary. So language structures within speaking, listening, reading, and writing. And so it looks like a textbook, and students do reading and writing activities with their teacher designed to sort of get them past this hump, past this. Usually where our students get stuck is they become very conversational, and so we assume they have the language skills they need to progress, but they don't always have the academic language that will support their writing and reading development.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mark.
In the slides, it was a great presentation.
Oh, thank you.
It was really easy to understand in a short period of time. In the slide, I think it was with the very early group. I don't want to go back. Integrating technology or?
Yes.
Okay.
Utilizing technology, yeah.
Okay, good, better word.
Yeah.
Utilizing technology. And so my question is there enough technology? Because it showed up in that one slide, but then are we providing enough technology at this point
Well, we're leveraging technology with that specific group of students, our newcomers and our beginning language learners. We know that the best place for our English learners to be is in the general education classroom, right? So we wouldn't necessarily want to have more technology for the sake of technology. However, if there's technology happening in the general education classroom, we would want to be providing supports and structures to make sure our English learners are accessing whatever's happening in the general education classroom. The reason we use it with our newcomers is because that's where we've got to get them up and running right away as quick as possible.
Okay. So just what I'm hearing is it's good, but we don't want to disrupt. There's that learning. You learn the language and you learn the content at the same time, so it might interfere with that as...
Well, I just wouldn't want to... I wouldn't want to bring in technology just because it's technology. So I would want to be thinking about technology within the context of whatever's happening in the general education classroom, and if it could... If it provided more access within the general education classroom, but not just as another language development tool. Does that make sense?
Another question. You're talking about parent engagement, and so the funding for that, is that a site-by-site decision, or is that in the district budget?
I don't know if I should defer to Amy, but through our Title III for parent engagement.
Well, let me think about this. It's more than Title III. We do receive just over $100,000 of Title III dollars, federal dollars, every year that are to support our efforts for English learners, but it's certainly not our base program. It has to be more and different in what we're doing. We also use some Title I monies to support parent education. 1% of those funds must be used for parent engagement, not necessarily for English learners, but to get parents onto our school sites. For the Latino family literacy classes that we're supporting this year, that is through Title III funding.
So when I look at those, I tend to ask this question, I guess, but it's like a lot of money on textbooks, and then it gets down to the thousands, just small thousands of dollars towards parent engagement. So with the success of this, would that start to take a different look? Or is the budget that you're putting, is there enough money for parent engagement, I guess is the question.
I think a big portion of what we use our parent engagement dollars for is recruitment, is to get parents to come to our meetings, to get parents, because it's really difficult for parents, working parents, parents that need to feed their children at night and do homework. And so we spend a lot of our time and effort in getting our families there. And then we really have no shortage of great family engagement programs. We have math nights, we have homework nights, we have Latino family literacy. It doesn't cost all that much money to do it. It's the effort behind it and getting our families to come and join us.
It sounds like the return on the dollar for the CABE conference was exciting. So is there a way to expand that? Within the dollars that you've got?
We currently have $6,000 set aside in our Title III budget specifically to send more parents this year, our DLAC leaders, as well as Don Addis and possibly another ELD teacher or specialist to attend. The conference is expensive. This year, the California conference is up in San Francisco. Last year, we went to a one-day specifically designed for parent conference. That was in Monterey. We were able to take, I want to say it was about 8 parents and EL teachers. We think we can take 6 with our budget.
Jim.
Well, I want to commend you on your presentation. I think it was very informative. Just a historical perspective, when I came into this district 27 years ago, there was a couple of itinerant ELD teachers. There were almost no materials for the secondary level. And there's been a huge change and a huge commitment over the last 15 years, in as far as my perspective goes, is realizing that they're not the ELD teacher students, but they're our students. And we may have to spend a little bit more to bring them up to a language proficiency where they're successful in school. So I really think the district has made huge changes in this area. The one question I have, you were talking about the, let's say at the secondary level, the teachers that are teaching, let's say, math or social studies and so forth, and getting them to be more aware of how to, you know, structure their classes through scaffolding or whatever to help the students. One of the things that used to frustrate me, and I don't know if it's still addressed, is that there's always now publishers have supplemental materials designed for EL students. And the frustration I used to have as an EL teacher was to go out to those teachers and say, well, look, you know, you have these materials in this supplemental material box or place. It would really be helpful to me if you would utilize those materials and you know, make sure that they get into the students' hands and that you become familiar with them. So my real question there is, what are we doing to encourage those teachers to use what's available to them?
Well, one of the super exciting things I think that's happened is our CPM curriculum for mathematics, because the EL strategies are embedded in the CPM curriculum, and they're also kind of embedded in the pedagogy of CPM. So in our secondary mathematics classrooms that we have CPM curriculum, students as part of the program are engaging in small groups or they're engaging in pairs. They have just some examples. They have roles, right, where they're supposed to do different things in their groups. They may even have sentence frames and different language activities. I was in a math class a couple weeks ago, and it was like, you know, it was build it, write it, say it, do it, you know, share it with the group. And so it's these, all of these things that we used to think of as separate are now becoming embedded into the curriculum that we're adopting. So that's one of the super exciting things, the shifts that are happening. And then because California now has a combined ELA-ELD framework, we're the first state that has said, no, this instruction needs to be integrated. And so I think as more materials are coming out and being adopted, we're going to see that it's not a separate box anymore or a separate thing that teachers are supposed to use. Much of it is built right into the structure, and it's not even like a separate column like they used to have in teachers' manuals. And if you have an IEP or if you have an English learner, do this other thing. Now it's really part of that, you know, first level of instruction. So it's been an exciting shift. I can relate to what you're saying.
Anyone else? Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
That was very interesting. Anyone from the public wishing to discuss this? Okay. Next, Measure D and other construction.
Okay, good evening. I know it seems like we're always here to issue yet another RFQ. However, I'm hopeful that this is probably one of the last we have to issue for a while. Tonight, we're seeking authorization to issue an request for qualifications packages from qualified firms to provide materials, testing, and inspection services. And so what these folks will do as part of our construction process will actually test the materials coming onto the site or being placed on the site. So in other words, taking samples of the concrete, curing those in a laboratory, and then crushing them to test the strength of that concrete to ensure it meets the design requirements and the code requirements for our projects. And this is all required by the Division of the State Architect. So this is a very necessary and very important part of the construction process to ensure safety of our buildings as they're being constructed and to ultimately get closeout with the Division of the State Architect. So we developed our request for qualifications. We reviewed that with Mr. Holcomb, and we're here tonight to get authorization to put it out on the street and hopefully solicit qualification packages from qualified firms.
Is there anyone from the public wishing to discuss this? All right, we'll come back to the board. Mrs. Roger, I see you're that reach.
Well, if there's no discussion, I just would like to move approval of moving forward with the RFQ for materials testing services.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Well, that was easy.
That was very easy. Thank you very much. We'll see you in a few weeks with a hopefully a couple firm or firms for approval.
All right. Revision to board policy 3350.
Yeah, so actually this came up last year with Julie Lang. Every year we get kind of an update from school services about the federal minimums, maximums for reimbursement for breakfast, lunch, dinner. So if an employee goes out on a conference or something like that, what the reimbursement rate's going to be. In the heat of everything going on with negotiations last year, we didn't bring it forward to kind of update it, bring it up. And then when I saw this at our recent update with school services again, I felt, you know, it's time. So as you can see from the board document, we're right now, San Luis Coastal is the lowest in the county in terms of our reimbursement rates. And so depending on what the board would like to do tonight in setting those reimbursement rates, what we would like to do in lieu of just, you know, letting this sit idle every 5-10 years, bringing it back, if the board would be willing to put something in that kind of allowed us to make adjustments to the reimbursement rates based on the federal minimum. So every year they come out with those minimum requirements in terms of reimbursements, and so we would just make those adjustments on a yearly basis based on what those federal minimums are. There are maximums as well, and it's a lot of it's based on where you live, prices, those types of things. But I think setting it at the federal minimum level would be a prudent thing for us to do.
Is there anyone from the public wishing to address this? Okay. All right. Back to the board for discussion, Mr. Buckman.
Yes, thank you. Thanks, Ryan. I understand that we're at the lowest now, and implementation of the suggestion would make us at the highest. And so I guess somewhere deep inside me I have a concern about jumping from the lowest to the highest. So we'd go to a total of 57, and the next highest would be 54.
And actually, when we sent this, just so that you know, so when we sent this around to all the other districts as well, they're all looking at kind of the same thing right now. So, in terms of this, so there's probably going to be some other districts that are going to look at that federal minimum.
Okay. So you guys have a side bet on the side?
No.
Can you do that with?
Okay. As you can see, it's been a long time since we brought it up.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that answer. And then the other question is, we don't address mileage here, and I think there's a federal
travel.
Yeah, that's outside of this. Yeah, reimbursement.
Okay. So it's a different policy. Different.
It is a different policy, but the board has already approved that to set the IRS rate, so it automatically adjusts.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Ryan.
Sure.
Now, is this for all, this per diem applies to teachers at a conference or?
The parents that go on Cabe conference.
So it's across the board.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Chris.
But I just want to be clear that this is for per diems without receipts, right?
Yes.
Okay. And I'm assuming that the $57, because it's a federal minimum we're talking about, I'm guessing, and I'd like some clarification from you on this, is it the same thing with the mileage where if we exceed the federal approval for mileage, then that's taxable income for the employee? So is that why we kind of choose that? Absent a receipt. So in other words, if an employee comes and says, I just want to take the per diem, we've set it at $57 mm-hmm. as the minimum right now, if we exceed a certain amount, does that all of a sudden become taxable income for them like it does with the mileage? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. You know, I'm not positive on that aspect of it. I know that if they actually bring a receipt, you can actually get reimbursed for more than the minimum kind of reimbursement part. So as Mr. Unger said, this is kind of the without a receipt amount that a person could get. And oftentimes, you know, whether they take the per diem for breakfast, you know, maybe the lunches cost more than the breakfast, you know, those types of things. It can vary for employees. Right. But I'm not sure on the taxable amount over the minimum.
And I would just like to point out for the public that any per diems or any receipts that we have cannot include alcohol.
Yes.
Anything else?
I'll make a motion to approve the to revise board policy 3350 to for language that states that our per diem reimbursement will be adjusted to the federal per diem minimum as is stated in the proposed board policy.
I'll second that.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right.
Thank
you very much. So next on the action consent agenda, please let me know if you'd like anything pulled. 11.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 11.02, adopt the board's bargaining interests for SLCTA. 11.03, disposition of surplus property. 11.04, disposition of surplus property.
No, I'm sorry.
Yes, you did, but that's all right. 11.05, approval of furniture and equipment requests. 11.06, approval of purchase orders. Okay, if someone could make a motion on everything but 11.04. And 11.06, we're pulling 11.04.
Thank you. Okay, I'll second that.
No, whatever we said. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Mr. Unger.
Yeah, and the reason I pulled the acceptance of donations is that I think it's important to recognize a donation that Baywood received for $5,177 from Joseph and Mary Dueling for purchase of the letter of the leveled literacy intervention kit, which I know will benefit the school. So I just wanted to, on behalf of the board, really thank them for that donation, and especially that donation to Baywood. And on that note, I would move approval of item 1104.
I'll second.
All right, all in favor?
Aye. Okay.
Moving on to reports by board members. Anything? Hearing none. Gone. This meeting is adjourned. Until Friday.
I think you've jumped ahead.
Advance agenda.
Oh, advance agenda. I'm so sorry. Just trying anything for advance agenda. Okay. So on... then we will adjourn until Friday, this Friday, because we can never have too many meetings in 1 week. November 20th, a study session to discuss graduation requirements in B3 at the district office, 9 a.m., followed by our next regular meeting on December 15th. Thank you very much.